Support for WPR comes from Tomorrow River Community Virtual School, delivering Waldorf-inspired live virtual lessons to grades 4K through 8th, open to all Wisconsin students. More is at trcvs.org.
Nice to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Glad you're along today as we begin our show by talking with you about the life and times of Ojibwe leader William Warren. He's the author of probably the most widely read and cited source on the Ojibwe people, History of the Ojibwe. It's also known as the Chippewa, of course, the Ojibwe. His narrative was written during his life. He was only 28 or 29 when he died. He passed away in 1853. And the publication of that particular book didn't come until 32 years later, in 1885. But he lived in an interesting time here in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and the Midwest. And it was a time that I, frankly, didn't know enough about. And I've learned a lot from reading the book written by Teresa Schenck. Teresa is an associate professor of Life Sciences Communication and American Indian Studies at the UW-Madison. And her book is titled William Warren, The Life, Letters, and Times of an Ojibwe Leader, published by the University of Nebraska Press. Welcome her to the microphones today. And certainly if you want to join in with your questions and comments as we move along, we hope you will. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Teresa Schenck, welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed your book. What possessed you to choose William Warren as a subject for your book?
Well, for a long time, I had been interested in his History of the Ojibwe People, and I had considered writing a new annotated edition. And as I read through the brief biography at the beginning of this book, I noticed there were a lot of errors. And so I kind of set out to correct the errors, and the result was a book instead of a five-page introduction.
Well, it's a fascinating book, not only because of the kind of person William Warren was, but also the times. To me, the sort of the history of that time period for Ojibwe, all Indian tribes in Wisconsin and Minnesota was really a terrible time for them in many ways.
Yes, it was a transitional time when the whites, the colonizers, were coming in, taking away their land, bringing in liquor, destroying them, destroying their hunting grounds. And so the Indians had to decide how they were going to react to this intrusion.
And William Warren was played a real key role in that. Let's go back toward the beginning of his life. Tell us how his father had a big influence on him, but maybe you could talk a little bit about his early life.
Well, he was born and raised on Madeline Island. He was part of the big Cadot family. The Warren family had married into the Cadots, and the Cadot family resided at the southwestern tip of Madeline Island. There was quite a compound there of about 8 or 10 homes where Michelle Cadot and his wife and his many of his children and their families all lived. So Warren was raised in a very extended family of cousins, aunts, uncles, grandparents. Ojibwe was the language spoken there. In fact, his father, Lyman Warren, was the only person who spoke English in that whole compound.
Oh.
Michelle Cadot, of course, spoke French, and some of his sons spoke French. But the language of all the women and also of the men was Ojibwe.
And so that's what he grew up, William Warren grew up speaking.
Yes, it was his first language.
And he learned English in part from his relatives, partly was it relating to his schooling, because he was sent off to school.
Yes, well, of course, his father tried to speak English to him, and he did learn some English. He went to school, first of all, on Mackinac Island at the missionary school there for Indian children. And later he went to school in New York, and there he perfected his English. But it has to be remembered that he only went to the equivalent of grammar school. Although he went to school for a long time, he never did get into what we would call today high school.
And yet he really distinguished himself in that very short lifespan. Relate all of the different positions that he held. My goodness.
Well, when he came back from school, I think he was about 16, within a year, when he was 17, he was made interpreter for the Chippewa Agency of LaPointe. So that was his first position held. Then he worked for a while as a clerk for Henry Rice. Then he worked again for the Bureau of Indian Affairs as a farmer in the Gull Lake region of Minnesota. He was elected to the second territorial legislature of Minnesota. And so that kind of does it.
And he was a historian besides.
Well, his idea, he probably didn't consider himself a history or historian. He was a storyteller, and he collected stories. And he realized that the Indians in their stories had a history. And he tried to put these stories into a chronological order. And that became his history of the Ojibwe people.
And I mentioned in the beginning that it was a widely read and cited source and a respected source for the most part, was it not?
Oh, yes. When it first was published in 1885, though, it's really interesting to read the people who had edited it for the press. They wondered if they'd ever be able to sell all the copies. And it's gone through, at least five printings since then.
Okay. Well, what impressed me, or what really was interesting to me, was the whole situation with the Indian tribes at the time that he was growing up and the time that he lived. And maybe you can talk a bit more about that for the Ojibwe and the other tribes.
What do you mean, the situation?
Well, what were the living conditions like for them at that point?
Well, during his lifetime, the Ojibwe were still living in bands. They were scattered throughout northern Wisconsin and northern Minnesota. There were no reservations. They did not live in cities or hardly in villages. There were some villages, but mostly they were living in bands and moving around as the according to the season to do their hunting, their gathering, their wild ricing. More and more, they were being thrust into something that would soon become reservations.
And about, what was it, 1842, I think, was one of the first treaties that you discuss in your book. And what was mm-hmm. that treaty about?
The 1842 treaty was really about the lands in northern Wisconsin and getting these lands, getting the minerals from these lands. Warren himself was not involved in that treaty. His father was present at the treaty. He was home at that time from school, but he was not part of it.
And the treaty, and so the treaty itself was involved with not taking the land away itself, but taking the minerals from the land.
Taking the right. But they also felt that they already had taken the land away from 1837.
But that was not felt by the Indians themselves.
No, the Ojibwe did not believe that. They believed that they had the right to stay on the land as long as they, as they called it, behaved and pleased the Great Father.
Yeah, the Great Father, that I've kind of wondered if that was actually, I've heard that in movies and sort of popular writing, but frankly, I didn't realize that was the term that was used for the President of the United States.
Well, the agents tried to establish this father-child relationship with the Indians by using the word Great Father, and that would put the Indians into the relationship of children to the father. And the use of this term kind of stuck.
You mentioned William's father, and I could tell, glean from your writing, his father had quite a great influence on him. But his father had some real financial problems and ran into some real trouble with the American Fur Company, if I'm not mistaken. And that, mm-hmm. that American Fur Company played quite a role kind of throughout this whole business, the mm-hmm. treaty business, and throughout the removal process of Indians.
Yes, his father was the chief trader and the factor for the American Fur Company at La Pointe from 1826 to 1834. And he got himself into trouble. Actually, most of the time that he was in trouble, Warren was away at school, so he did not understand the full import of this. But Lyman Warren, from 1834 to 1836, was ordered to move the American Fur Company buildings from the southern tip of Madeline Island up to what was then called Sandy Bay, or La Pointe as it's known today. And he was also instructed, because the furs were declining, to make it possible for the company to go into a fishing business. And he was ordered to build a wharf out from into this bay so that fishing boats could come in and unload fish. Now, Warren had some other interests at this time, namely lumber mills, and so he did not do a good job at estimating the length of this wharf. And as a result, the wharf was too short. The company had a great loss in fish because they couldn't bring the fish in. A lot of fish rotted. And by 1837, Warren was blamed for the mess that the fur company was in, although he was not totally to blame. He was blamed for it. And in 1838, he was fired.
And he lost a lot of money. He wasn't paid. There was money that mm-hmm. was due him. He wasn't paid that money. And eventually, it drove him crazy.
Well, exactly. He had several problems here at this time. He lost his interest in the lumber mills. That was a big mistake. They tried to put a lumber mill at a place where it shouldn't have been. He lost his position with the as a farmer for the mm-hmm. Indians on the Chippewa River. He had lost all that other money that he put into the lumber mills. He had put something into the treaty of 1837, a $25,000 debt owed to the American Fur Company, and he believed that he had a right to at least $10,000 of that money. When he was let go, they disregarded his claim, and so he lost that possibility also. And in 1843, at the instigation of Alfred Brunson, he initiated a lawsuit against the American Fur Company. And, of course, this is a little man of Wisconsin taking on the huge American Fur Company of New York. And he eventually, within 2 years, he had to withdraw his suit. But at the end of all this, he was so depressed, and he just gradually went into a state that even William called insanity.
It was and really too bad, and it also led, I think, to William hating the American Fur Company his whole life and sort of doing battle with that company his whole life.
Yes, he did, and he himself had problems with the American Fur Company. It was the traders of the American Fur Company that tried to bring charges against him about misinterpretation, that he did not interpret correctly. And he was cleared of those charges, but as he wrote later, a fire will ever burn in my heart against them. So he, for his entire life, he carried a grudge against the company.
Teresa Schenk, our guest, Associate Professor of Life Sciences, Communication, and American Indian Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She is the author of William Warren, The Life, Letters, and Times of an Ojibwe Leader. It's published by the University of Nebraska Press. Questions or comments for her about the times that William Warren grew up in? Feel free to join us at 1-800-642-1234, or in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking with Teresa Schenk today, author of William Warren, The Life, Letters, and Times of an Ojibwe Leader, published by the University of Nebraska Press. If you'd like to join in, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. William Warren was a mixed blood parentage. Obviously, his mother was what was the parent? His father was white.
The father was a New England white man.
Yeah,
and the mother was what we would call Ojibwe French.
Mm-hmm. And he, despite the fact that he was not a full blood Indian, he enjoyed the respect of pretty much all Indians of the time. What made him, what gave him that respect? How did he earn that respect?
Well, the first of all, he was related to them, so they always called him brother or cousin or son, grandson, nephew. He had so many relatives throughout both Wisconsin and Minnesota among the Ojibwe. But I think it was because he spoke their language perfectly and because he was a storyteller. And he started out by exchanging stories with the Indians. Mm-hmm. When he came back from school, he would sit with them around the fires at night and exchange stories. And he would tell them the stories he had heard in the Arabian Nights and his stories from the East. And they would tell him stories. And I'm sure at that time he had no idea of ever writing them, but he did collect them in his memory. And by the time he left Wisconsin and went to Minnesota, he was starting to write them down. And this gradually led to the Ojibwe, the history of the Ojibwe people.
Yeah. Mary in Madison, let's give you a chance. Hi, Mary. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Thanks for the program.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering how important agriculture was and how it shaped the Ojibwe life.
Well, at the time of William Warren, the Ojibwe were engaged in some agriculture. Ojibwe, of course, would go to the Bad River area to where they kept their gardens. The gardens were mostly corn, potatoes, squash. It's interesting that even at this time, the government furnished farmers who taught the Indians how to farm in the American style. The government furnished seeds and implements for farming, and this was by treaty. So the Indians were interested in farming, and it was thought that they could even farm as far north as some of those northern areas of Minnesota, maybe not successfully.
Yeah, not successfully. Thanks, Mary. Appreciate your call very much. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. So Warren was well-liked and respected by the Indians and obviously had some measure of success. How with whites and others in the community, how was he viewed publicly?
Well, he was seen, first of all, as the best interpreter, so that the best interpreter, that is, of Ojibwe, so that whenever Indians came to St. Paul and the legislature was in session, he would be called out of legislature to go interpret. This is not to say nobody else could do it, but they thought that he was the best. The Indians themselves preferred him, and when they had complaints, like in 1852, they had complaints about removal, the Indians asked for him specifically, and the governor would not send for him, and so the Indians went home. They simply would not take anyone else as an interpreter. So he was viewed publicly as a very fine interpreter, but also as the person most knowledgeable about the Ojibwe, and this was because he had written several articles in the paper, in the Minnesota papers, about the warfare between the Ojibwe and the Sioux, which had increased at this time. And through these articles, he became known as a person who really understood the Ojibwe.
And he also, as part of his job or as part of his work at one point, actually did some, I guess you'd call it census.
Oh, yes. The census of 1849 he took in three counties. Yes, and then he took Indian censuses also.
Yeah, and the Indian censuses, I think, were kind of important to him, too, because of what the information he gleaned, not only just the numbers, but the other stories as well.
Probably one of the most important things that came out of his Indian census taking was the use of figures to stand for names. And he took an entire census of one band using these figures for names. And these were not totems. These were not totemic, but these were other signatures. And he sent these to Henry Schoolcraft, who included them in his book, one of his books on Indians, but never gave Warren credit for it. But when you find it in his original papers, in Warren's original papers, there it is in his own handwriting. So you know that he did it.
That's very interesting to me. I was fascinated by some of the Indian chiefs, particularly Hole in the Day, a guy by the name of Hole in the Day. I wondered, how did he get his name? You may or may not know that.
Well, it had to do with the kind of a hole that's in the clouds when you can look up and see the sky above.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, he was a fascinating guy. You have some great photos in your book as well, and there's a great one of him, a strapping, handsome,
yes,
young man, who,
yes,
to be a chief.
Yes. This is Hole in the Day II. His father is also Hole in the Day, and he was just about a year younger than Warren, and he always called Warren my elder brother. And they were friends. They had some little difficulties between the two of them. But in the long run, they remained friends, and they respected each other.
Yeah, he's a fascinating guy. Carol in Brownsville, Minnesota. We'll go to you next. Hi, Carol. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I'm wondering how this William Warren, if he was referred to as W.W. Warren, I wanted to know if he's related to Truman Warren of the White Earth Reservation.
Yes, W.W. Warren is William Whipple Warren.
Okay.
And Truman was his brother, his younger brother.
All right. I'm of that tribe, the Ojibways and the White Earth.
Are you a descendant of Truman?
No, but my nieces and nephews are. And I wanted to know if there was a transcript of this interview that you're giving right now that I could send for. I'm sure those kids would really like to know this.
Well, I tell you what, we don't have transcripts, but what we do have is we put all of our shows online, and so you could send them to Wisconsin Public Radio and go to this day's date, and they can hear the show live.
All right.
Or recorded, I should say.
And I would also add, you might want to buy the book for them.
All right. Tell me the name of the book.
It's William Warren.
William Warren.
The Life, Letters, and Times.
Okay. Is this just out?
Yes. It's published by the University of Nebraska Press.
Okay. And who is the author? Tell me again.
Our guest today, Teresa Schenck. And Teresa's last name is spelled S-C-H-E-N-C-K.
E-N-C-K.
Well, yeah, I'm sure your relatives and friends would be interested in this particular story.
Yes. All right. Now, get back to the site, Wisconsin, WPS.com.
Oh, I'm sorry. Wisconsin Public Radio, WPR.
WPR.org. .org. All right, I'll get that right on. Yes, I wrote a book about my family, and I included a lot of history of where my parents were born on the White Earth Indian Reservation, and I drew a lot from a book called A History of White Earth by Mrs. Julia Spears.
Mm-hmm. Julia Spears was William Warren's and Truman Warren's sister.
All right. Well, I've included that in my book that I wrote, too. So
excellent. Carol, thank you.
It was very interesting. Keep going.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. At the time, and you sort of got into this a little bit, Teresa, but Indians were seen as sort of an obstacle to the progress of the American way of life, end quotes. How was Warren viewed publicly? Talk a little more about that, if you will.
Well, I think I started this, that he was viewed as an interpreter. He was and a person very knowledgeable about the Indians. He was seen as in part Indian. In those days, you did not make a you were either Indian or white. There wasn't this category yet, or it was just coming to the forefront of mixed blood. He was seen as in part Indian. But after the failure of the second removal, when he was blamed for the entire failure, an article appeared in the Minnesotan, one of the papers, and they called him a man possessed of all the duplicity of the Indian. So the attitude toward him changed very much after the failure, and he was very much hated.
And I just maybe you can set the stage for us. You write and the writings that you have from William Warren and from your own research really graphically describes the attempts at removal. And just so people understand what was going on here, maybe you can talk a little bit more about what the Indians were asked to do, travel long distances, well, just to the site of where they were to receive money and so forth. Maybe you can talk about that a bit.
Well, it's interesting that the idea of removal was really encouraged by some people right here in Wisconsin. In fact, I found a letter from some of the citizens of Teresa, Wisconsin, no relation to me, asking for the removal, the immediate removal. And then the Minnesota State Legislature passed a law to remove the Indians. This was very strange because they were not living, the Ojibwe were not living anywhere near St. Paul. But in 1850, the president or somebody standing in for him issued an order of removal. And the Indians greatly objected to it. Warren himself was of mixed feelings about this. He thought that it was a good thing to get the Indians away from the liquor, and especially on the Chippewa River in present-day Chippewa Falls. There were a lot of saloons there, places to buy liquor. The Indians were being plied with liquor, and he thought that the removal would be a good thing for that reason, just to get them away from the liquor. So he did support the removal, but the Indians called for him to come over in 1850 and explain to them. And so he did. He went over to, he was living at the time in Minnesota. He came over to the Chippewa River area, went around and met with all the different bands living there on the Chippewa River and the Red Cedar River. Explained to them what it was and said, at least go and see what it's going to be like where they want to remove you. You don't have to stay. Just go and see. He was not an official at that time. He was not acting for the government. But he did accompany them to Sandy Lake where hundreds of them died from bad food, from starvation, from dysentery.
Measles.
Measles. His own children were affected by this because they went there too. So after the failure of this removal, the government decided to try again in 1851. And it was in 1851 that he was hired by the government to help effect the removal. And he did go, but he had an idea at this time. I think it's a remarkable idea for the time, and that is to unite all the Ojibwe into one strong tribe rather than small bands so that they could oppose the government and work as a single unit instead of as small bands. His efforts for this part of removal failed. His efforts to unite the Ojibwe failed not because of what he was doing, but because of what others were doing in the removal. That is, there was a rumor that the removal had been stopped for various reasons. They stopped. The Indians stopped going where they should have, where they thought they were going to be going, and so the removal actually failed.
Yeah. Al in Toma, we'll go to you next. Hi, Al. Thank you for calling.
Yes, my grandfather taught. First of all, the Ojibwe, they got guns, and they drove the Sioux out of Wisconsin and Minnesota. Very few people talk about that. These original lands were Sioux lands. But anyway, my grandfather taught Chief Charlie Goodsky of the Chippewa. The remnants are up there in Dead Lake. He taught him how to farm. And when the chief was a big, strong, healthy man, wise man, started farming, the bucks kicked him out of the tribe because the bucks like the wild rice and just hunt and everything. And
I'm going to turn that back to Teresa. I think that's not a term that I would use in talking about the Indians, about the men in the tribe. But did you know the name that the caller gave us for
Red Sky? Yes,
Red Sky. Yes. You knew him?
Well, no, I didn't know him.
obviously didn't know him and know him, but you knew of him. And
the incidents that he's talking about really happened after Warren's time. So it doesn't pertain.
After his time. Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for calling. Patty in Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, Patty.
Hi. I was just wondering if I could kind of pick the brain of your guest there. I've been trying to do research of my family for the last 5 years, but up in Brown County, Wisconsin, for the Menominee tribe. And my great-great-grandparents, my great-great-grandmother was Washi Sosat, a full-blooded Menominee Indian, and she married a French fur trader named Tion Taylor. And boy, oh boy, sometimes they're listed together, actually, on the census, and other times they're listed without their children. And you were mentioning something about them sending kids away to school?
Well, this was in the 1830s, yes.
Well, yes, and that's what I'm talking about, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, if the fur trader could afford it, and usually if he had connections, he could send them away to school. But there was also a school at that time on Mackinac Island.
Okay, so if they're up in Brown County in that area, would they be going to that Mackinac? Do you think the school there or?
I don't recall seeing any Menominee names on the list. I have seen the list, but I.
Do you have any research anywhere to send me for to find research on the Menominee list or in that area?
The list of students is in the American Board of Commissioners of Foreign Missions papers. That's called the ABCFM papers. It is in the archives or the library here at the State Historical Society, and somebody there could probably help you find it.
Yeah, and maybe we could talk a little bit about how you did your own research on this. Certainly, the State Historical Society was very helpful, but mm-hmm. You had other places to go as well.
Well, the primary area of research for me has been the Department of Indian Affairs, the records of the Indian Affairs. But you have to just look at everything, and you have to take every clue and use every clue and just keep following it and following it. It's almost like a detective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you, one of the things that I was really impressed with in your book were the many letters that you were able to uncover. William Warren was and you did a little bit of minor editing of his work.
Minor, yeah.
Very minor. He was a very bright, eloquent writer, and I really enjoyed the letters that you had in there.
Yeah, one thing I had to edit, though, was his spelling. He insisted on writing E before I. So the word chief, every time he wrote it, was C-H-E-I-F. Punctuation was not his strong point either. But his letters were, some of them were known already because they were in the Bureau of Indian Affairs. But the most exciting letter I found was the last letter he ever wrote. He was on his way back to St. Paul. He was in Chicago, just passing through, and he heard that William Gates LeDuc was on his way to an exposition in New York. And LeDuc had been his, he owned a stationery store where he bought his supplies in St. Paul. And Warren had left his book in New York because he was afraid that it just, it was not going to get published.
Yeah.
And so he wrote to William Gates LeDuc a very sad letter asking LeDuc to go get the manuscript and to get it published. And this was something that nobody had ever known, how it actually came into the Historical Society. And so finding this letter in his papers, it was a very weak handwriting. He was only about 2 weeks from dying. It was written in pencil. He usually wrote in pen. It's a very, very touching letter.
And we should mention that one of the reasons, probably the main reason he died at such a young age is that he was injured in part of his government work, as a matter of fact, years before.
Yes. He was accompanying the La Pointe agent in the winter of 1846-47 on an investigation of how many Indians were actually, how many Ojibwe were actually in their territory. And apparently a limb of a tree fell onto his chest. And from then on, he had very bad chest pains, and he bled a lot from his mouth. He vomited blood. And this continued for several years. And it's generally considered it aggravated some TB that he must have had already.
Yeah. And so he was ill for a good share of the time while being responsible for, obviously, his own wife and family and children, plus some other relatives as well.
His sisters, his younger sisters, his younger cousin.
Because his father was insane at the time.
Well, his father had died in 1847.
Yeah, and died in 1847.
And so from 1847, when this injury happened, until his death in 1853, he was quite ill most of the time. In fact, his sister says that he wrote his book mostly lying in bed, propped up with pillows.
And in all the traveling that he had to do, I mean, you just didn't jump in a car and drive across the interstate. I mean, we're talking walking tens and hundreds of miles and fording. The descriptions that you have in the book are fascinating.
Canoeing,
lots
yes.
of canoeing.
Yes.
Well, he was a fascinating guy, Teresa, and this is a fascinating book. Thank you so much for talking with us about it today. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Larry.
Teresa Schenck is an associate professor of life sciences communication and American Indian Studies at the UW-Madison and is the author of William Warren, The Life, Letters, and Times of an Ojibwe Leader. It's published by the University of Nebraska Press. I found it fascinating. Reading, enjoyed it very much, and I hope you'll have a chance to take a look at it. It's a really interesting book about Wisconsin and Minnesota history and the life and times of a guy who lived during that period, and the life of quite a few other people is chronicled in the book as well. William Warren, The Life, Letters, and Times of an Ojibwe Leader. Well, coming up, we're going to be talking with you about Macintosh computers and accessories. Switching gears, I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.